We had an 8-man crew, but because of the power block and some of the innovative ways of cutting the overhead on a seiner, you've cut from 8-man to a 4-man, 5-man crew. So then the boat pullers are set left out in the cold again. And that's the one of the reasons why I'm an advocate of the people who are entitled to be compensated with a limited entry permit. If you couldn't give them a seine permit, then at least you should give them a hand troll permit.
Do you understand what the point is here? That unless you were a permit holder, you're not eligible for a permit. And now that the cash value of the permits has become so extraordinary, if you don't have one in your hand, the odds of your being able to obtain one are almost zero. Meanwhile, it makes it more possible for the business people from down south, and with all due respect, the school teachers and others, to buy into the fishery, while the people who may have fished all their lives are systematically being eliminated. So some kind of revision of the limited entry system to protect the local resident from a fishing community is necessary. Forgive me for interrupting.
I just ask you a question about that.
You've been explaining to me how the loss of the food fishery or the personal fishery and for one's family has, on the one hand, been experienced, and yet at the same time, in terms of the commercial fishery, limited entry has worked to exclude native people. So that gives rise to some arguments about sovereignty as a means of protecting these things. It also gives rise to something else that that is going through my mind as you speak, and that is, you put the hypothetical case of a man with a shared quota being up against it, hard times, and some big operator comes and says, okay, I'll buy your quota. That sounds an awful lot to me like what might happen about shares in the native corporations after 1991. And in limited entry, now you had some experience with that. Maybe you could tell me whether that has happened with limited entry. Have those holding permits seen them soar in value, sold out? You say that they aren't obliged to sell to people in their own community, so the permit goes to Seattle or anywhere. Have you seen, have people been selling their right to participate in the limited entry fishery?
Well, you know, it's like the only way that I can respond to that is it's like anything else in the world, you know. You heard about the toilet paper scare. There was going to be a shortage of toilet paper, and everybody ran to the supermarket and loaded up on cases of toilet paper and stored it in their basement or in their garages. I think this is what happened at limited entry. There's going to be a limited entry, and the people that were connected with some of the hearsay and street talk, and especially the ones that were leaking out from Fish and Game, the friends of the friends from Fish and Game actually said, yes, these are going to be the magic years. And then everybody actually put a gillnet drum or something on a skiff or whatever, or a hand troll device on anything that floated. So then we recognize the same thing happening in the halibut fisheries. 3 years ago, someone said there also is going to be a limited entry on halibut. People who really didn't intend to fish halibut for a livelihood actually put a drum on there for halibut fishing, so that they would actually gain a limited entry permit. These are some of the things that we experience, you know, and I'm sure that the natives from the rural communities have no intentions of actually putting a handline on their skiff, basically just to gain a limited entry permit. This is their livelihood. And these are the reasons why we have a lot of sale of limited entry permits on the market today, are those recipients had no intentions of actually participating for their livelihood in a limited entry or in the fisheries. those are the people that we're having problems with today. And they're the ones that actually severed the lifeline of those people who are actually deserving of those limited entry permits in a rural community. But then, I mean, if you don't actually do the research, as I indicated earlier, that we know that you can use a yardstick. We have a formula on the workforce in the communities. We have those people who cannot work, the handicapped, the children, the people who are 65 and over. You know, those are the people. And then when you actually look at the workforce, those are the people that actually can participate. Those are the formulas that I'm talking about in the fishing industry also. There are certain people who can participate in the fishing industry, and I think those are the people that did participate. And the state could actually have looked at this particular situation at 70% of the workforce. Those people that didn't participate are actually probably employees in a school, probably in the in a store, local store, or in a local restaurant, those type of things, and it's easy to figure out. So, but before I also just get carried away on limited entry, I got a little emotional on when I talked about loss of my dad in Dundas Bay. We talk about my father and my family, my brother and I also, we had mining claims in Dundas Bay Lake, which also the federal government kicked us out because they didn't have, we couldn't prove that there were valuable minerals on the mining claims. And yet, the Department of Interior know that Newmont Mine Company was bordering our mining claims. And today, Newmont Mine is still in the same area as in Dundas Bay. But you see, those are some of the reasons why I talk. I feel that I get really concerned when I talk about Glacier Bay, but then getting back to limited entry, I'll let Pete go ahead.
Well, I just think in answer to your question, certainly yes, that occurs. Also, the problem of the permit as a commodity is a real problem. You can't sell your driver's license. Why should you be able to sell your fishing license? The argument that possibly you shouldn't be able to sell it but should be able to inherit it is one solution that's been offered. Another has been to take away the ability to transfer the permit after, say, 15 years, so that those people who do acquire them year by year would be paying less and would also be showing an increased commitment to personally fish rather than just to resell it. But my personal opinion is yes, because of the financial value of them, sometimes they get transferred to people who are more interested in buying and selling permits than they are interested in actually fishing commercially, and the burden has been felt in the smaller communities. One example that's a good one, possibly tomorrow or next year or 5 years from now, the opportunities for hand trawlers will increase. Today, the opportunities for hand trawling are becoming increasingly limited due to competition from other gear groups, variety of factors. And a hand trawl permit is down around $5,000 today. What a wonderful thing to be able to go out in a small boat and hand trawl for your living. It's just the economics of today that have the price down. Well, a lot of people are selling off their permits. And if the regulatory structure of the state of Alaska changes to make it more favorable for hand trawling, then that permit price goes up. And those same people who may have been hand trawling all their lives, who said, oh well, the way the law is today, I can't make a dime off it, I'm going to sell my permit, tomorrow maybe they could, and the permit's gone and the price is up to $35,000. The whole structure of the limited entry system, and combined with regulations that tend to favor the same fleets, tend to favor corporate ownership of these fleets rather than private ownership of smaller vessels, has led to a real crisis among fishermen in the small villages. And once again, a look at the regulatory structure and the laws which govern the transferability and access to permits is certainly due. And the conclusion of my first remark was that the people in the small communities were sold this limited entry to protect their rights, when instead the manipulation of the regulations and the marketing of the permits have worked in the opposite direction. I don't have much else to say, but I would certainly think that there are people here who could tell you stories from their communities and personal stories about friends of theirs who have had hopes for limited entry and then have found that it's caused them a lot of difficulty. Might be able to give you a clearer picture of the nature of the problem, and maybe then you'd get some thoughts about solutions to recommend, but I would defer to the group.
I'm interested in what you've said, Mr. Gall and Mr. Martin, because it shed some light on the movement for sovereignty by Native people. It also, as I say, is a kind of maybe a warning about what could happen to shares in Native corporations in 1991 if they go on the market. And
I'd like to just say
one
sentence about that, because I don't want to intrude upon the people who hold shares in the corporation by expressing too many opinions, but at one time I never believed that the federal government would come in and do anything to protect the land base from being broken up by the sale of shares. It seemed to me that the history of this country has not shown that the federal government, when really called upon to act, has come forward and acted in behalf of the indigenous people. And that's always been very, I of course share the sadness in that. But my hope would be that some action take place, and I hesitate to say it, and I would hope that people who don't agree with this point of view would come forward and share their thoughts with you, but my feeling is that unless some action is taken to stabilize the land holdings of the villages, that will occur, that the land base could very easily be destroyed, and I think that would be the saddest day in the history of the state. So I don't wish to advocate a particular legal solution, but I do think that's what is necessary, is just as the law of limited entry created this problem, just as the law of the federal government created the parks issue, just as state law is creating the subsistence issues and the sovereignty issues, I think that this Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is leading us to a point of great danger, and something in the law is going to have to be done to help preserve this land base. And beyond that, I guess I can't be any more specific, but I would hope that your work might lead to some recommendations.
Well, thank you both. I just want it understood that I'm not really going to be in a position to, and nobody's asked me to make recommendations about limited entry, but the experience with limited entry may be very, as you've outlined it to me, may be very useful to me in indicating what the consequences of shares going on the market in 1991 might be. That's so it's been very interesting and useful to me.
I think I want to thank you for giving me an opportunity to ask those questions. I know we exhausted limited entry, but in closing my remarks, I think the limited entry actually could be compared with the restrictions that is continuously haunting us. As you know, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act indicated that, and also now that 1991 is coming upon us, we also have to be faced with those restrictions on relating to our stock, and there, who knows, prior to the next 10 years, there'll be other restrictions, you know, and I'm making my remarks in relationship to the sovereign rights that we're actually all concerned about. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to also ask you another question, if I can. Referring to our native holding, holdings within our corporation, that our stocks will become available on open market in 1991. And there was some good examples who were brought out through the limited interest, as you stated. When the native fund claims was first being implemented, I raised a question. I still stand on my point of view that I stated that.
Excuse me, you getting this?
I stated that in a meeting when John Borbidge was the president of the last corporation, that if there was going to be any buybacks within a month, if our stocks become available on the open market on a maturity date, that the first option be given to our native regional corporation and to amend that act. I understand they're still amending the act, I'm not understanding correctly. Rather than going to a large corporation using, for instance, like an example, using Standard Oil or whatever, like how many buy a whole lot of open stocks, and that our native corporation be given a chance, regional corporations, the ones that have wished to sell their stocks, an individual like myself, so we don't fall in the category of the limited entry. I'm very aware of the limited entry. Majority of our people in Hunan and Dune about 75% of the people in the village areas were dependent on the fisheries. And now today, I believe out of Rangoon, there is only a full-time commercial fisherman. I don't know how many are participating out of Hunan and Cape. But this is what limited entry done to us, and it could very well happen with our native stocks within the corporation, village or regional corporation. Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Yes, sir. Excuse me, Jeff, did you get everything Mr. Martin said? Yes, sir.
My name is Dick Folta. I'm an attorney who have represented some native groups, including Chilkoot Indian Association, and I would like to supplement Mr. Clayton's remarks the other day. I hope I'm not duplicating what he said. Concerning the Chilkoot Indian people, which the Chilkoot area is near Haines, and I'd like to point out the apparent failing of part of the Lands Claim Act, whereby it provides rather arbitrary criteria for determining a claims village that is 25 people or traditional village site. Chilkoot, from what I understand, was one of the four most important Indian settlements in pre-Western times, a very significant establishment. And because of the ravages of smallpox and influenza, among other things, the village was literally destroyed, and by 1920, it was essentially abandoned. And therefore, it failed to meet the criteria under the ANSCA Act as for village status. I think it's important to note that on a case-by-case basis, I think investigation of the Chilkoot situation would have resulted in it being established and being eligible for land. As it turned out, it was not, and the people were dislocated, and there are a substantial number of Chilkoot people who have been shunted aside, essentially because of the Act's arbitrary provisions in determining what is a village and what isn't. That was my essentially what I wanted to say, Justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Hammond.
My name is Austin Hammond. I'm from Haines. And I've been listening to all these words coming out about fishing. And I know Martin was asking where it belongs to fish, Haines or the others. This is what I'm fighting for. Up in Haines, Chilkoot, what they have to do. I try to stop a lot of things. We know all fishermen needs the fish I've been fighting for. Up in Chilkoot where it's spawning, they've been trying to put the road through locking. That's where it was spawning, all the sockeyes. That's what it goes to Chilkoot. This sockeye, it's real, helps a lot of people. What's coming? And then they've been asked of the line was went down, farther down where the line was. And Darren too, I've been fighting against it to move it down. Give them a prisoner a chance so they could fish too. In Haines, they're really fighting. But the man, he's got accident, airplane accident, he died. The one who used to fight. So these boats are coming from all over, down Seattle, all the commercial fishermen. And I'm sure glad Martin brought it up and asked him. I've been fighting about this year. Let's have it in three places, fishermen's, from Seattle to Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, and then Taku and Haines. Why I'm doing this here, I'm trying to fight it, because all the boats comes up. That's why I try to hold it back, but I didn't make it. Nobody did help me when I was talking in the convention to the Fish Commission. So I told them, these three ways if we spread it, then we'll have our chance. When we're waiting in Haines, waiting for the fish, we don't go no place. We stay there. But the Fish Commission said we can't stop them. They got a commercial license. And I told them, sure, we could stop it. Us, we living in Haines and Tlaquan. Joe just left here. I'm sorry he left. I asked him, just before I say something, that time when I was talking with that Fish Commission, when I told him, sure, we could stop it, this land suit we're talking about, just like we sold the land. We didn't sell the land. The way it came, the gold in June here, the gold mine, where is they taking the gold? This is what we had to have to sue, and the logs and the fish, they're taken away from us. So I told that fish commission the way they telling me. The line, I know where is the line, where they paid from, all the way up to Haines, it belongs to us. I will mention the name, Saint Mary Point, Burness Bay. That's where the line is. And they sell down this way. Why they do? In Haines and Tlaquan, they didn't take no locking yet. So the man, his name, Paul, William Paul Sr., he comes up, he's my uncle. He comes up to Haines, then he talked to us. We're going to sue again. After they took the logs out. But now the fish is, they're taking it out, we're putting it down, how much fish they're taking away from us. So they log there. But if they do help me with this fish, and Martin was asking, cut it in three places, we could have this fish in yet. They wouldn't move the fish line down again. What it happened, all the fishermen comes up to Haines and Chilcat side. They just clean them out. Over 200 boats comes up. That's a small area in Haines. Why they do move it down? Too many boats comes to Haines. So they move it down. I'm not really sure where maybe Thunder Bay. And they beat me with that. When I was here, when I got back, that's when I heard. If we do fighting with each other in convention time, we could have everything what we need, but we didn't. We are all fishermen. I myself am a purse seiner with my dad, Jimmy Marks. Halibut fishing, we the one started. I think it never did. Halibut fishing. We started by pulling by hand. That's 200 fathom skates. We tied up together five. Then we pull it by hand. First start. So they make fun of us. When we're doing this here, well, probably wouldn't say nothing. Well, we got to have something to eat. We got to make a little money. Finally, he find out what is the better way to do. In Sutka, the man was there, young man. He's the one teach me to be a ruler man. Still nobody goes out. In Huna, we got Tennessee, the boat named Tennessee. We using that. Finally, next time we see some boats came out. Look at that halibut fishermen. They used to make fun of us. It's the work we're doing to show with my pop, Jimmy Mark. What he do, they do it. Power skiff, they never used to use it. They used to use an outboard motor. And Pop used to say, look at that boat, how it's going to pull. It comes off that nil when you start to pull in it. So he's got the power skiff. That's where it started from. These fishermen, we are all natives. All that boat comes up from down below, Hollywood. And the other one, President Coolidge, they call. All the boats comes up, big boats. Also got a small boat yet. I know all the fishermen in Huna. So this, now I'll say, I wish we could work together. And I heard the small boat doing halibut fishing. I got a small boat, I'm a halibut fisherman. Last year I got over 8,000 pounds in 2 days. I learned it from my father. He teach me. The other thing I was talking about, Chilkoot, how I try to protect the fish. I need lots of help. The road's going to go up around the lake and they're going to lock way up there. Why I'm fighting against it? The road, they don't have nothing. There's no place to spawn. Now that place where they're going to clear cut, up above Chilkoot Lake, there's lots of mountain goats there. I try to protect that. Lots of moose there. And there is a brown bear. Right now the bear went up. It's quite a few hunters went up from here. And what they do when they kill that bear, they took the skin out, they threw the meat away. Our clinker don't waste nothing. We use everything, what we kill. Sport, we talk about. This is what spoils us. Sport fishermen, hunting, sport hunters, they just wasting it. They try to blame us Tlingit, but we don't do anything like that. So I like to see someone to help me to leave that Larkin alone up in Chilkoot. That's a real spawning lake there. And they're going to build a road across on the other side. A road comes on this side, and they're going to build a road on the other side again. There will be nothing left. Why I'm doing this for the grandchildren? That little girl's running around. They're going to grow up. They're going to have a children. What are we going to leave for them when they grow up? And here we try to clear out the whole place. I hear Sitka. It looks funny. This is George Lewis who was talking about. It looks funny. Just like a man when you cut and you hear bald headed. That's the way it looks to him. That's the way it's going to be in Haines too. There will be no more spawning place in our place. And I'm working for my children and I built some smokehouse there and I teach how to put it up. And I teach them how to put some berries before the jars. Then I teach the story, tell them the story, and what we use for medicine that we tell them. This is what we're doing in Haines. That's part of it. Dick Folders talk about it. This is my doing. The reason why I did it, the fish where they put it there, where the tide comes close to it. That fish where they would dig it down, could say about 5 feet deep. Till they see they got enough fish there, then they pull the rods out and count on the fish going in. Sometimes they just leave it there. That fish was full, that hole. When the tide comes, the fish turn back. In Tlakuan, they never used to have a humpies. Now, they got lots of humpies going back from Chilkoot. And they're killing lots of fish too. That rod, they put it together. When they pull that out, what's going in there? Next time when they look back to that rods again, the tail goes in there. They can't swim it out again. Sometimes in day, you could save about 50 to 100. But when they see that fish dead, they pull the rods out and let it drift it down. This is what I'm fighting against it. And the sport fishermen we're talking about came down from interior Indian, some from downstates. They put some deep freeze on a car. They don't use a spoon. They cast in the sockeyes. If they catch one humpy, they just throw it in the grass. And that freezer, it folds up, and they took it up. All these Canadians. But us, we can't go in there, anything what we need to kill it from there, or either get some fish from there. This is a sport fishermen doing, and they've been blaming us. On Chilkat side, the king salmon, they've been talking about it. There's no king salmon there no more. So I ask where it is, big boulder they call it. Our white people, they made a lot of mistakes. When they make a mistake, they said the Indians doing it. All these trinkets, they've been eating a lot of fish. Now that big boulder, when that big waterfall, it went on the other side. So they clean out the river. It's just like this flow, there's nothing there. So the king salmon can't go up there. All this white people's doing. And they put some galvanized pipe so the river could go through. And there was a sink in it. That's what spoils the whole thing. So I'm glad Martin brought it up, all the things. I was just going to listen. So this fish I'm talking about, the Chilkoot, it helps a lot of people. All the boat comes from Seattle. So now I'm going back in the morning, so I just have my last chance to talk with you folks. I'm thankful to listen to me.
Well, I'm glad you came.
Thank you.
My name is Gene Strong. I hope you don't think I'm trying to crowd the floor, but every time people come up here, it renews some of the ideas and things that I wanted to say the first time. But I'm getting more relaxed and these things are coming back. But reaffirm what Austin was talking about, where he was talking about where the fish was getting caught in those pipes. He's referring to the fish weir that the fishing game put in for counting the fish. And I can't understand why there couldn't be another mechanism to count the fish, because in common sense ways, the way they got that fish weir goes from one bank to the other where the fish can't even go through. And if they get tired or get caught in the water, they can't swim back out. That's what he's referring to. They get caught between the pipes. But there's only one entrance for it, the fish, and it's right in the middle of it. And that's a deterrent for the fish for going up the Chilkoot Lake, because they can't find that hole unless they keep pounding their heads against those pipes until finally they find that hole where they go through, and that's where the fishing game put their fish counter. So I don't think that is really a true accurate way of counting, because as I say, it was a deterrent for those fish to go up, so a lot of them probably just go back down to the ocean and never do make it up, or a lot of them don't even make it through there. But I wanted to touch back on what Martin was talking about, this fishing permits and et cetera. When I came back, I used to be a fisherman myself when I was a youngster, and my dad, and I can identify with Austin Hammond, and there's probably Martin's too. We used to fish, we had a Columbia River boat, my dad and I, and I was pretty small, but we learned fast. I can remember the Columbia River boat was only 26 feet long and had a little four-cylinder engine in it. And I, too, used to pull the nets by hand before there was power rollers. And my other friend that was here but had to go back to Skagway was Cy Denna Sr. He was also in that area, like most of us. We pulled nets by hand, 200 fathoms long. I wasn't strong enough to pull the cork line in the weather, you know, when the elements were up. So I always pulled the lead line, and my father put his feet up on the back of the boat and pulled the weight of the boat to us, and I helped pick the net. Then I went into service, fulfilled my duty to the U.S., and come back and found out I couldn't fish, because I hadn't fished earlier, but I found out a little bit later that I could have, by serving my country, I could have got a fishing license. But then I went into it, instead of doing that, I didn't want to fight with the system that was at in the time, in the 60s. So I decided I'd learn a trade, to be a mechanic, because that was easy for me to do, is mechanics. But when I come back up again after my training, the employment was pretty low in Haines, because the sawmill's been getting shut down, and I missed the pipeline, because they told me when I came back in 74 I was no longer a resident, because I was out of state too long and I'm born and raised here. I was just out for training for my future. So I missed out on the pipeline. So I decided, well, I got to do something. And at the time I worked at the sawmill when they shut down, there was a job opening in Skagway. I went up there and I got a job, and that was only a temporary position as a heavy duty mechanic for cats up there. And so I looked for a boat, and I found a boat pretty reasonable, and I was able to get an interim use permit for hand trolling, because I had to prove that I was fishing, you know, have some kind of record or something. So after I spent my money for the boat and got myself all geared up to go hand trolling, which I wanted to do again because it was something that was easy for me to do because I'd done it in the past, they moved the fishing line from from the Chilkoot line down to Seduction Point, and then from Seduction Point to Point Retreat, further down the Lynn Canal, then down where they had to fish from Berners Bay to Point Retreat, all around in Juneau for hand trolling. Well, I didn't mind that too much, but except for my boat. It took me 2 hours to go 15 miles, so I couldn't afford to go down that far to hand troll. I tried it, but for the cost of gas and grubbing up and everything, and the season was short, because it was, all these things seem to come when it rains, it pours. So I decided, well, I guess I'll just have to try to keep working for the railroad. But in the meantime, they quit sending me the interim use permit because they said I wasn't fishing long enough. Well, most of my time was running, and I couldn't get that quota that they told me I had to have because my travel distance was 90 miles. And it took me 2 hours to go 15 miles. It was, and for 2 or 3 days fishing, then have to come all the way back home. It wasn't economical feasible for me. So that's why I decided to become a railroadsman. And now that is shut down, so I'm in limbo or transition again. But I wanted to touch on that areas of the fishing license and our trials and tribulations on that. It seems like this commission brings all this stuff up that happened to us in the past, brings it to a present today, and refreshes all our memories of what it could look like in the future. Thanks for you to bringing that point out earlier with Peter Gall and Martin. And it's really vivid in our mind that without the federal government providing assistance to us for this unique situations we have up here, it's going to cause a big problem. This is what I've been alluding to, where the sovereignty thing comes up. We are going to probably take the bull by the horn and assert ourselves. That's why I was alluding to all these problems. That's why the sovereignty things come up. We let it lay on the side for a while because we wanted to work with the laws that was being imposed on us. But now we're run out of space. So much for that. And thanks to Dick Folta, he reminded me of the Chilkoot problem when the village used to be there. The same thing happened in Skagway. Skagway and the Dai area, which is next door to Skagway, between just north of Haines, 15 miles. Skagway used to be our Tlingit place to dry fish, to goat hunting, and hooligan, and picking berries, and that was our trade route to the interior before the white man came. And then when the white man came looking for gold and shortcuts going into the interior for the gold up there, they found the Indian trails where the railroad goes by and the highway goes by today. And they took that trail and hired the Tlingit people, because they were strong people, to carry their loads and their burdens over the mountains. And to this day, you never hear that, the Klondike Gold Rush Trail. It's always the white man thing, which was, it's a wrong concept for everybody, because the tourists asked us, well, what happened to the Indian people? Because they know Alaskans is predominantly native people, earlier to the territory of the United States, or Alaska became a territory. So they keep asking, but this is hushed because the village in Skagway used to live on the creek beside the mountain. But when the engineers and people that was looking for a railroad to go through there moved in at the same time, Soapy Smith and his band of crusaders, it pushed the native people out. There was a lot of prejudice in there, and a lot of the records that stated the things I'm saying was burnt or lost, or, you know, was just literally lost. And the people, the native people that was still there before they moved out, was able to recapture some of those records and put it in the archives, some in the archives in Carcross, and some in the archives in Whitehorse, some here in Juneau, and some, and a lot of them in Sitka. But now it's hard to find those to corroborate our traditional village council in Skagway, which I reenacted, or it was always there, it just was dormant. That's going back to what Dick Folter was saying. There's a lot of villages there, and there are still native people there. And so I brought it back to life, but now I have to prove to the federal government that we used to be there. But all the records has been destroyed, and most of the records were passed from generation to generation through by verbal speech. In Dai, there used to be 1,700 people there before the slide, the snow slide that wiped out the people in Dai. Where the bridge is up there, that steel bridge now, was the north end of town of Dai. Across the bridge used to be a big church, but the river's cutting out. Where the river is now used to be the main street of the Dai village. And I tried to get Sea Alaska, since they designated the Dai gravesite there, which was the native gravesite. They selected it for historical gravesite. I tried to get a corporation, which I'm a shareholder of, to help us up there to try to stop that river from eroding the gravesites away, which just recently took about a dozen bodies and bones down the river. The Park Service was instrumental in helping us before they become domineering. But the reason why that river started cutting over there was when they started logging in that area. DOT put a bridge across there and built a dike out and caused the river to change of direction. And everybody knows the river is more powerful than anything in this world of moving gravel and rocks, because it's continuous. But I went around and talked to a lot of people in Southeast to ask them what they know about Dai, to try to get information. And at the same time, they're trying to do the same thing for their villages. So I had a hard time. And a lot of our elders has passed on that knew the stories. Unfortunately, when I was a kid, I heard the stories, but it rolled off my shoulders because I was too interested in working or playing. But as I got older, I start realizing the value of those things, and then I start recapturing the echoes in the back of my brain what my grandmother and fathers and uncles and their forefathers used to tell us. I'm trying to recapture those things. A lot of them I remember by having these people mentioning things, then it brings back those memories. But those people in Skagway have the same problem of not having recognition as being an Indian tribe or a council up there, just because most of those people were pushed out by prejudice from Skagway, and then the slide and the diseases from Dyea, and then besides the bandits that Soapy Smith caused. And then the fishermen used to fish from Skagway. We used to fish clear up to Skagway, but that was eliminated because more fishermen from the lower 48 came up and was too congested, and finally there was not enough fish going up the Skagway Inlet. And now, getting back to the fisheries back in Lynn Canal and the way the laws are looking with these new fishing licenses, as was stated earlier, to me, I feel the reason why the federal government isn't doing anything and why the state is hesitant to do anything is because the big commercial fishermen outside the Alaska boundaries, inside the 200-mile fishing limit, have a lot more political power than we do as individual fishermen in the inlet areas. So we consequently have to relinquish our fishing grounds and pack more fishermen in each one of those. So then when that happens, the fishing game says, well, we're going to have to cut down the time limits. And actually what we're doing is subsidizing those commercial fishermen outside the, or fishing on the inside of the 200-mile fishing limit. And those people out there fish for everything and anything, from shallow on top of the ocean clear to the bottom. And they drag everything up and leave us with no escapage, or hardly any escapage, but what we have to catch, we're supposed to let go because there isn't enough escapage going to the fishing grounds. I don't know if I'm getting that clear to you, Roy. This thing, since I've been working for dollars instead of fishing for my use and traditional things, I'm looking at inside the window that he used to be looking out of, and this is the perception I see coming, that that's what's going to happen to our small fisheries entrepreneurs that's in the Lynn Canal or southeast, and that is happening. Same thing is happening to the interior of Alaska, and I'm probably happening up there in Canada. I don't know too much about that one, but this is what's happening today. That's why they close out Glacier Bay. They just keep closing out every place, and pretty soon you have to have big boats to go out there in the ocean. We can't do that because we can't afford it. But I do appreciate what this commission's doing, and I hope the commission would make recommendations to the ICC to have the tapes played aloud to the members so they can hear the voices coming from the voices instead of just read, because that has more impact on to the person's mind if they can read it and follow, you know, with your transcription, but hear it on the tape. Because then they can feel, hear the voices coming from the people throughout your interviews. And that'll make a more positive impact. Because they, and also to the United Nations. Because see, that's the thing I feel that they need to hear, the urgency of the people that they're looking for. The shortfalls that we're seeing now that they can get around before they have to do the same thing we do. It means a little more impact on them. That's all I have. I touched on what Austin Hammond had, because that brought those memories back, and what Dick Folter was saying for is the same thing in Dyea and Skagway in the fishing laws and my experience with the fishing industry and the shortfall I had with that, the inequity of not being able to keep up with the laws and the distance of where the fishing grounds are moved out to. Thank you.
Good evening. Yeah, to bring my notes with me, my brother and I were supposed to get down together. My brother's name is Richard, but he isn't here tonight. Maybe I'll borrow Gene's over there. Well, I think we'll come here before you in the morning or in the afternoon. My name's Alfred McKinley Sr. I was born and raised in Hoonah and migrated between Hoonah and Excursion Inlet and Glacier Bay. And sometime in May or June, we used to pick sea lakes, you know, over in Glacier Bay. And I was a kind of a scared individual to pick sea lakes. One time I fell down and rolled down and had all the aches all over me, you know. So, but that's what I remember about Glacier Bay, picking sea lakes. And we used to go there and shoot seal and go up there and shoot mountain goats and all kinds of things like that, you know. And now we are prohibited of going up there and shoot mountain goats or even stamp on land, you know. And they let the tourist boat go up there, you know, but when we're going up there, you know, they kind of stop us, you know, and kind of take that as a harassment. And we were in that area, grew up in that area. My father's name is Jim McKinley, and my mother's name is Margaret McKinley, and we did reside in that area. From the history that was conveyed to me from my grandparents, that there was one lady, her name was Costine. When the city, or from the way the story was passed on to me, the ice was actually receding, you know, so our people had to evacuate the area. Of course, everybody went different directions, but there's one old lady there stayed behind and watched, made certain that everybody was safe, you know. Well, as I grew up in Excursion Inlet and Hoonah, we went back and forth between there and Sitka, Tanaki. You might say that my grandparents probably came from Angoon, or between Angoon and Tanaki, and I do have relatives over there, and also they have moved from Tanaki to Hoonah, the Jack family. All these things I've been hearing about. I used to help my dad. He had